listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, scientists have found that the bacteria in our microbiome, the ecosystem in our gut, can affect conditions like obesity, acne, allergies, and more. Now they're studying how the microbiome affects the performance of elite athletes. We'll talk about the findings so far with our guest researcher. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. More details have come in about cutbacks by paper company Kimberly-Clark, and two Wisconsin communities will be feeling the impact. Robert Mentzer is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. Rob, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks.
Well, Rob, last week we talked about the news that Kimberly-Clark, which was founded in Wisconsin, was going to be making some big cuts. We didn't know where those were going to happen. We're getting some details. What are we finding out here in Wisconsin now?
Right. The long and short of it is 610 jobs lost in Wisconsin, and the company will be closing two plants in the Fox Valley area, in Neenah and a plant in Fox Crossing. So there's a third plant in the area in Marinette that will not be closed, but the first closure will be in Neenah. It will happen within the next 18 months. The second plant, the company hasn't released a timeline on, but it will be within the next couple of years.
Can you talk about the impact these plants would have on those communities?
Well, so Kimberly-Clark is the third largest employer in the Fox Valley area. And this is, 610 jobs is a major loss for sure. The company makes, you know, Kleenex, they make Huggies diapers and other products like that. And they, you know, as came out last week, where they're making these big global cuts. They're cutting something like 12% of their global workforce, about 5,000 jobs. And, you know, it was easy to imagine, I don't know, or maybe it was wishful thinking to imagine that many of those cuts would not be centered on Wisconsin. I mean, many of them aren't, but that's a significant share of the company's overall Wisconsin force.
What have we seen in reaction from local officials and politicians?
Well, I mean, one thing, you know, we don't know what the economy is going to look like in 18 months or in 2 or 3 years when these closures occur. But there are, you know, economic agencies are quick to point out that we are at a time of economic strength. And in fact, in the manufacturing sector, what you hear the most is that they're looking for skilled workers to hire. They're concerned about a shortage of skilled workers. The workers in these Fox Valley plants are skilled manufacturing workers, so there may indeed be opportunities for them. But again, I mean, that's projecting out that's still going to be the case in a couple of years, and it's a trauma no matter what to lose a job that maybe these folks have had for many years.
And this is happening at the same time that Foxconn is preparing to build a factory in southeastern Wisconsin with the help of incentives from the state. Here's Outagamie County Executive Tom Nelson talking about that.
We have $3 billion for Foxconn. Surely there's some support that we can offer a homegrown industry like the paper industry.
Is he the only one making that kind of case, or are other people looking for some kind of state support here?
So I think that these particular job losses are probably already baked. I don't think that there's a lot of hope that Kimberly-Clark will reverse this decision. Although there may be a drive for that. That may be something that we do see developing in the next year. I wouldn't say that that's impossible. But I do think that in general, you know, people who are paper industry types or, you know, professionals talk a lot about the ways that the market is tilted against American manufacturers, and there is some truth to it that's been found in, you know, sort of international governing bodies that American paper manufacturers are undercut by international manufacturers in China. So there are calls for political action on the issue.
And also, just turning to the retail sector briefly, a lot of retail stores dealing with problems. We found out this week that Bon-Ton, the parent company of Yonkers and Boston store, is closing some of its stores here in the state. What kind of impact does that have?
Sure. So nine stores, these Yonkers department stores. The company is closing 42 stores in all, and nine stores in Wisconsin. All told, it's something like 400 jobs in Wisconsin across these nine communities. And these stores are going to close soon, roughly within 3 months or so, according to the company.
Talking to Rob Mentzer from USA Today Network Wisconsin, looking at some of the big news of the week around the state. Want to turn to the possibility of Tesla dealerships in Wisconsin. This is the car manufacturer, electric car manufacturer, Tesla. They want to open up their own company-owned, as I understand it, dealerships. That doesn't mesh with Wisconsin law that says you have to go through another dealer if you want to sell your cars in the state. A new bill could change that. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, so this is interesting. Yeah, Wisconsin has a law that prohibits automakers from sort of running their own dealerships. And the law originally was supposed to protect an independent auto dealer from being put out of business by, like, one of the big three Detroit automakers. And the idea was if you're selling Chevys on this corner and Chrysler decides to target you, what can you do because you're just this independent dealer? But of course, the big three are not as powerful as they once were, and as the law exists today, it does have the effect of insulating auto dealers from other types of competition. At least that's the argument that the Republican lawmakers are mounting as they introduce this bill that would exempt Tesla from this law.
And why do Tesla and their supporters say they need an exemption from this law?
Well, so Tesla makes electric cars, and so they're in somewhat of a different kind of business than other automakers and other auto dealers. Basically, there are a lot of dealers in Wisconsin that can easily sell you a Chevy, but they're not really set up to work with consumers and explain to people what it means to drive an electric car and what you need to have an electric car. And so so Tesla's their business approach has been to sell online and sell in dealerships that they control, where they can sort of like manage that whole process. And they say that's a significant enough difference from traditional combustion engine dealers that they should be allowed to give it a shot.
And what's the counter argument then from opponents of this idea?
I mean, it's that the Teslas are not banned in Wisconsin. You're allowed to have one. You just have to drive to Minneapolis to go to a dealership. Ultimately, it's a question of political power, and the franchise laws do protect auto dealers. I mean, they don't like it because it would have the effect of potentially undercutting their business.
And finally, Rob, I want to turn to a local high school sports story that's gotten some attention. You've been watching it. The coach of the boys basketball team at Appleton East is gone. John Milkey had been coaching the team for 18 years, abruptly retired last week. Give us the backstory.
Yeah, this is wild, and yeah, this is has been a huge story in the Appleton community. A group of parents after a game confronted Milkey, who, yeah, you said has been there for 18 years. It's a little bit unclear. There was an accusation that he yelled at the players too much, but also there was also the accusation that his team didn't win enough. As a result, he just abruptly announced that he was stepping down, and there were several assistant coaches that also resigned at the same time. The basketball team there has had to continue under some new management.
So I don't know the ins and outs of the arguments on both sides here, but from a process point of view, if you're an aggrieved parent, the meet and yell at in a bar strategy may not be the path to follow.
Yeah, I mean, this is the latest example, right? There are examples probably in every community of parents who take their youth sports maybe way too seriously. And there definitely are coaches who are abusive, who might maybe yell at kids too much, and idea whether John Milkey was one of them or not. But yeah, the process, you would think that there would be like a complaint and an investigation and a decision, and not gang up on a guy in the bar. But sometimes you get what you want, sometimes you don't.
Rob, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
All right, thank you.
That's Robert Mentzer, statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. He joins us every week for a look at some of the top news stories of the week in Wisconsin. Coming up, there are trillions of microscopic bacteria that live in our bodies and make up our microbiomes. Scientists have been studying the microbiomes of a lot of different groups of people, including elite athletes. We'll talk about some of what we know and still don't know coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the mayor of San Juan, Puerto Rico, says many are still without food and water on the island. We find out why a federal agency backtracked on a decision that would have stopped sending aid to the island. First, studying human microbiomes, made up of the trillions of microscopic bacteria found in our bodies, has only really been on scientists' radar for a decade or thereabouts. So far, they've found that our personal microbial makeup relates to things like acne, allergies, obesity, anxiety, cardiovascular disease. The list goes on. One point of curiosity for these scientists is how the microbiome of the elite athlete might be different from the rest of us. Embriette Hyde has studied thousands of microbiome samples as the project manager at the American Gut Project. She recently left that position to pursue science writing, hoping to make her research more approachable for the public. Embriette, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Really looking forward to it.
Well, I gave a very basic version of what the microbiome is. Tell us a little more about it. What is our microbiome?
Yeah, well, most people today, just when they think of the microbiome, they think about the bacteria that live inside of us and on our bodies. And while the bacteria are certainly included in that number, it also includes fungi and eukaryotes. And then there's a viral component as well, so all of the viruses. It's just that bacteria are a little bit easier to study, and more people have studied them. And so we know more about the bacteria that live in us and on us than those other microorganisms, but they all play a part, and they're all probably very, very important to what it means to be human.
Yeah, a lot of us, I think, when we hear bacteria, virus, fungus, we think of those in the category as things to avoid. But it turns out these guys are doing a lot of good work for us.
Yeah, most bacteria in your body are friends. They're good for you, or they just don't do anything, positive or negative. Most of the bacteria out there are not the pathogens that make you sick. I don't know that we know as much about the fungus, but I would imagine it's probably similar. And viruses are interesting little critters. You know, the flu that's been going around, that's caused by a virus. But there are viruses that infect bacteria, too, and only infect bacteria. And so there's a lot of research interest in how we could maybe use the viruses to be our friends, too, for when we do have to fight off those rare bacteria that are actually the ones that make us sick.
It looks like, as we were saying, the bacteria and everything else in there looks like it has a lot of effects on our health, maybe for better or worse if things aren't going right. Are we getting to a point, though, where we can look at our microbiome and use it to help diagnose problems and tweak it to help solve problems?
Diagnosis, certainly not. We're still pretty far away from that. It's just so complicated because human systems, they're exactly that. They're a system. So we have the bacteria, but there's also our immune system. There's our host genetics. There's our environment. So the things that we eat, how much sleep we get, and how much exercise we're getting, all of that affects all of those systems. And so it's really complex to try to figure out how all of those things are interacting with each other. Machine learning is a computational tool that a lot of people think have promise for identifying things that can help diagnose. But that's still pretty young. Adjusting the microbiome to help with certain symptoms, there have been several people who have tried to do that. There are many forms that can take. Diet is probably the least risky form, and it's also one of the fastest ways to change your microbiome. So a lot of people who have had, inflammatory bowel syndrome is a really great example. The FODMAP diet, which is based on the types of oligosaccharides and polysaccharides that you're eating in your food and how the bacteria interact with those components of your food, it's proven to be pretty helpful for a lot of people. with irritable bowel syndrome, and it's probably because it affects the microbiome, but we don't know exactly how. So there's a lot of this anecdotal evidence of if I eat this diet or if I do that, it makes my gut better. But why? Like, what is it doing to the microbial community in there? So that's what scientists are still trying to figure out. Because once we can understand that, then we can really be more directed in what we're telling people to do and how we're helping them achieve better health.
We're talking to Embriette Hyde about our microbiomes, the bacteria and viruses and fungus and more that live inside us and do a lot of work on our behalf. Embriette, I understand you're particularly interested in athletes and how their microbiomes might or might not be different than the rest of us. Why is that something you're interested in pursuing?
Well, I mean, I'm an athlete at heart. You know, I grew up running track, and now I'm running half marathons and doing CrossFit. And so I love the athlete mindset, and I love being around athletes. And so if I can have the opportunity to try to understand the athlete system more and help athletes perform better, that's just awesome. And, you know, I love the microbiome too. So now I'm combining my two passions, which is really cool. Not a lot of people get that opportunity.
And so you're sampling elite athletes, trying to get microbial samples from people who perform at high levels. Is that right?
Not just elite athletes. We're also sampling. So the biggest effort that the American Gut Project has been involved in was sampling the student athletes at UC San Diego on campus. And so while they may be a higher level athlete than, you know, me, for example, I go to CrossFit every day. They're certainly competing and working out at a much higher level than I am. They haven't reached the athlete stage yet. We have sequenced athletes. It's just a smaller number of elite athletes that have been sequenced through American Gut. However, there are other research groups out there that have looked at elite athletes too. So we have these kind of separate groups of data sets that exist looking at surfers or looking at elite bicyclists or looking at Olympic-level rowers. And so the data sets are growing, and the researchers are very good at collaborating and kind of sharing data and talking about the data so that we can get a holistic picture of what's going on in the elite athlete.
I imagine one of the many complications here might be if, okay, we find that, yeah, these elite athletes, they have this distinctive thing about their microbiome. Is it that that microbiome is helping them be really good athletes, or is there something about being an athlete that's affecting their microbiomes? How do you try to sort that out?
You actually asked a very good question, and that's exactly why it's so tricky, because elite athletes especially are usually engaging in very particular lifestyle habits that also can change their microbiome, whether it's what they're eating a very specific diet, or how much sleep they're getting. Many elite athletes sleep, you know, 12-plus hours a day. And they're traveling a lot. So all of these things can affect the microbiome. So you really need isolated systems. And it's hard to do with humans. You essentially can't isolate a human. You can't tell a human, you know, live in your house for the next 6 months, eat the same food every single day, and, you know, don't do anything different. You can do that with animal models, though. And a lot of research groups are using mouse models. Some of them are germ-free, which means they don't have any bacteria at all. They're completely sterile. And so when you introduce a specific species of bacteria into their system, you can see what that specific species does. So, for example, if you wanted to see if a certain species could make a mouse have better endurance when he's running on his wheel, you could put the mouse on the wheel after feeding him this bacteria as a probiotic and, you know, compare it to mice who haven't gotten that bacteria as a probiotic, and see what happens and compare. You know, you can compare endurance, you can compare measures. That's just the first step, though. Eventually, you do have to test it in humans. And so that's why sampling a lot of people and testing these things in a lot of people is so important, because you have all of that noise in the background that's just associated with being human and being different. So that's sometimes why it takes science so long, because animal systems are great, and you can see awesome results in the animal model. And then as soon as you move into humans, then you start seeing weird stuff that doesn't make sense that you have to try to figure out.
And Embriette, from reading up on this, I understand I can, if I go out searching online, I can find products I can buy and take that will promise to boost my microbiome and improve my athletic performance. Assuming I wanted to be an athlete, should I buy these things?
I would not recommend that at this point, because I don't think the evidence there is really convincing yet. That's a really bold claim to make. It's possible, just like, you know, when people who take probiotics, that makes their gut feel better. So maybe there's some anecdotal evidence, and maybe it could have a beneficial effect on some people. But there's no systematic clinical trials that have been done with products to show, you know, without a doubt, that in 70% of people you see this increase in performance. It's just, we're not there yet.
And as somebody who studies the microbiome and is an athlete, even if they're not proven yet, are there foods that you eat that you're thinking, okay, I don't know, maybe this isn't clinically proven, but yeah, why not? It's not going to hurt anything. It might help something.
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, it's pretty well known that bacteria loves to eat dietary fiber. So that's bad news for some people who don't like vegetables because vegetables are full of fiber. But there's a lot of evidence out there that suggests a diet higher in fiber is quite good for your microbiome in the sense that more species are there. It's a more diverse community. It's a healthier community. What that means for you is going to depend on you. But like you said, it certainly won't hurt. And so something that I've done is try to make sure that I'm including more high-fiber foods. So beans are very good. Lentils are very good. Vegetables, of course, are great. The other thing that I really love to eat is fermented foods, foods that have been fermented by bacteria. If you do it yourself, the bacteria are still living on the food when you eat the food, and it's delicious. And there's a lot of evidence there as well that they're very good for the gut. Now, I don't know if that's improved my athletic performance at all. Personally, I think just making sure that I'm eating the appropriate amount of food and macronutrients for what I'm trying to do has been more effective. But it certainly doesn't hurt, like you said, and, you know, our doctors have been telling us for years to eat more vegetables. So there's obviously very good benefits associated with that that aren't related to the microbiome, too. So you're going to make yourself healthier if you do that.
And, Briette, thanks a lot for joining us today. Appreciate it.
It's been great. Thank you for having me.
That's Briette Hyde, former project manager at the American Gut Project and a scientist and editor at January, Inc. She joined us to talk about the study of microbiomes of elite athletes and how they compare to the average American. Coming up, a federal agency announced it would stop sending aid to Puerto Rico this week and then backtracked that announcement after criticism. We find out what the situation is like now on the island months after a devastating hurricane. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday after 6 on The Morning Show, a lot of people are betting money on Sunday's Super Bowl, but there could be some big changes in the works in the world of sports betting. Kate Archer-Kent and her guest look at a Supreme Court decision that could shake things up. That's Monday morning after 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, announced this week it would stop sending aid to Hurricane Maria survivors in Puerto Rico. The agency later backtracked that announcement after public outrage, saying it had never intended to stop providing aid. Over 4 months after the hurricane, San Juan's mayor, Carmen Yulín Cruz, told CNN Wednesday that Puerto Rico is still recovering.
Just this past Monday, 3 days ago, I had to send to a school 45 minutes out of San Juan water and powdered milk. These children have no electricity, have no running water, and there wasn't enough food for them to take care of themselves. So this is not mission accomplished. And I think that what has happened is that Puerto Rico and the botched effort and the inability of President Trump to show, forget true leadership, to show empathy as a human being has become a black eye in the United States and has become a black eye for the Trump administration.
Charles Venator Santiago is an associate professor with a joint appointment in political science and El Instituto Latina, Caribbean, and Latin American Studies Institute at the University of Connecticut. He's with us for an update on the latest news from Puerto Rico. Charles, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, and good to talk to you.
Let's start with this FEMA announcement and this back and forth. What do you make of what we saw from FEMA this week?
This is part of an ongoing negotiation. So FEMA had originally talked about transferring all the resources to the Puerto Rican government so the Puerto Rican government could manage it, particularly at a local level, at a mailing level. And then after the exposure by NPR and others in the complaints in Congress, they backtrack. But part of the challenge also is that the food stuff that FEMA is providing is not necessarily the best food stuff for people.
What do you mean?
They're just providing simple water and sometimes MREs or ready-to-eat meals. And sometimes they're providing food that is salty and sort of canned and not necessarily the healthiest food for the average person.
When FEMA initially told NPR that they would end aid to hurricane survivors, Alejandro de la Campa, its director in Puerto Rico, had this to say.
So we need to bring back the economy of Puerto Rico. People need to start buying in supermarkets. You know, it's obvious that if you get something for free, you're not going to go buy it.
What do you make of that argument? If we stop sending food for free, the economy will start bouncing back as people buy the things they need.
Part of the challenge is that there's not enough electricity to fuel most of the companies in the area. So we're still talking about 40% of the population without reliable electricity in the island. So small businesses aren't up. There's a lot of unemployment. So I'm not sure where the money's going to come to fuel the local economy without functioning electricity or functioning commerce in the island. So a lot of folks are dependent on food because they just are unemployed and don't have access to money.
Can you give us just a bigger picture, a sense of what things are like in Puerto Rico in this long recovery effort?
So right now, part of the problem is that there's a lot of infrastructure damage. And even though the federal government has offered some relief, the Puerto Rican government has been unable to manage funding to that
We're losing our connection, Charles. I'll have our director give you a call back. Maybe we'll try a different phone if possible. We're talking about the latest right now in Puerto Rico, the long recovery effort from the hurricane there, months after the event itself, and some back and forth from FEMA about how aid would be provided. You can join in with your thoughts if you have connections to Puerto Rico, if you've been there, if you have family there. We'd love to hear from you and your thoughts on the administration's response in this ongoing recovery effort and the place of Puerto Rico as part of the United States. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Looking at the latest from Puerto Rico, let's try our guest again. Charles, can you hear me?
Yes, sorry, I'm in Washington, D.C.
Yes, we lost our phone connection there. So you were talking about the conditions on the ground now in Puerto Rico.
So there's a lot of infrastructure that needs to be repaired. There's not enough electricity being generated or electricity being transferred. So commerce is sort of down, or at least it hasn't picked up enough. There's been a lot of talk about migration. So a lot of Puerto Ricans are moving to the mainland, working-age Puerto Ricans, so people who would be fueling the local economy. There's high unemployment because commerce is not functioning. Water is still unstable. Not everyone has access to water. And we're going on 6 months living under these conditions. And the government's bankrupt. There's not enough liquidity for the government to function in the island.
From the federal perspective, what could Puerto Rico use from the federal government that hasn't happened yet?
One of the things that the federal government has asked for is an appropriate system to manage federal funds. And the Puerto Rican government has had a hard time providing numbers, statistical information that's useful, or creating an agency or government agency, local government agency that can guarantee that federal funds are not going to be mismanaged.
Can you talk about the Puerto Rico government? What are the roadblocks to them being able to do those things, to manage relief efforts and even to provide information that would help with those relief efforts?
Part of the problem with the Puerto Rican government, and this cuts across political parties, there are two main political parties that have been doing this for years, is that it's run based on a system of clientelism. Somebody gets elected, the mayors then send the people who elected those folks to be employed. So there's a lot of inept people working in the local government based on a lot of clientelism and a lot of corruption. And the bureaucracies are inefficient. They're mismanaged, and they don't have the resources to have standards in place. Permits are hard to issue. People are just not trained to run government agencies in the island. And part of the problem is that the federal government has offered some relief, but there's no partner to manage resources. Now, the challenge is that the governor has been trying to distract from this debate by pushing for statehood right now rather than figuring out how to fix the government. There is an effort by Congress to use the Fiscal Oversight Board to start managing, or rather micromanaging, but it's not clear that they have the capabilities right now to manage government agencies, to use money and resources in an appropriate way.
So this sounds like a really obviously a hard problem to tackle, but more so than we might have thought. There's the direct damage of the hurricane, the infrastructure you're talking about, an already troubled economy being hurt by the hurricane, but then a territorial government that is unprepared to deal with a situation like this. I mean, how do you even get started there?
That's a great question. The first thing that I would do is I would create or assign an agency that can coordinate resources from the federal government and the Puerto Rican government at every level, and that can manage resources, money, to be more specifically. And this could either be done through the Financial Oversight Board, or this could be a congressionally appointed or presidentially appointed board. But there has to be a commitment to manage federal funds and resources in an effective and realistic manner. And then they need to hire people in Puerto Rico who know, understand the area, and who are willing to work and who need jobs.
Do you see any signs that that's happening? Are there efforts to make that kind of board happen?
There have been some demands by Congress and legislators to the Puerto Rican government, and there have been assurances that the government is moving in that direction. But again, right after Hurricane Harvey, or 2 days later, the governor of Texas already had a plan to accept federal money. It took the governor of Puerto Rico 40 days to begin to talk about a plan. You can go to any state government and you can get a public accounting of the expenses and the budget of the government, state government. In Puerto Rico, the federal government has been asking for years to get an accounting of the government. So there has to be some sort of political change in the island, and a move away from traditional clientelist and corrupt politics to a more bureaucratic, or rather technocratic, state where people are willing to help. The human capital is there. There are enough people who can do good things in Puerto Rico and who are looking for work. We just need to move beyond partisan politics.
And it seems like there is some finger pointing. We heard from the mayor of San Juan saying this was a Trump administration problem. We've heard people blaming Puerto Rico more. It sounds like a more of an all of the above sort of situation.
This is a complete failure of government from the president down to mayors in the island. And everybody has a share of the problem. Everybody shares in the problem. The problem with President Trump is that he hasn't exhibited leadership. He hasn't created an agency that can help manage all these resources or interventions, and he's put a lot of limits on FEMA and a lot of federal agencies. To give you an example, right now in Connecticut, we're talking about treating Puerto Rican migrants as homeless, because that's the only way they can get access to funds to support them in their situation. This is something that FEMA should be managing. If they're going to move people to Connecticut, they should be able to finance or help them finance their lives until they can get back on their feet. And that's not an option.
Charles Venator Santiago is with us from the University of Connecticut. We're talking about the latest in the long recovery effort from hurricanes in Puerto Rico. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you know someone who is still in Puerto Rico, someone who has left Puerto Rico? Is that you? Have you relocated since the hurricane? And what do you think of federal efforts to help in Puerto Rico? What needs to happen? What needs to change? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our look at the latest from Puerto Rico. Charles Venator Santiago is with us from the University of Connecticut. You can join in at 800-642-123. How do you think the federal government should help or support Puerto Rico now? And do you have connections with Puerto Rico, friends there, family there? Are you from there yourself? What are you seeing? What are you hearing? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Charles, we heard from a caller who couldn't stay online, Jay in Viroqua. He said if this happened in one of the 48 continental states, this would have been taken care of. Puerto Rico is kind of, he says, out of sight, out of mind for the public and for political leaders. What do you think?
There is some of that. But remember, Congress assumed responsibility over Puerto Rico back in 2016. Puerto Rico is a U.S. territory. So in that sense, Congress does bear a responsibility to govern the island. The problem is that there hasn't been much discussion around whether Puerto Rico should be treated as a part of the United States or whether it should be treated as a foreign country. That's one. And then the second issue is that I think in the States there is a perception that, or there's a demand by the local population, that agencies need to function. That's not just about what political power parties in power. And that's not part of the history of Puerto Rican politics.
These aren't things that are going to be solved quickly, right?
No. They're talking about electricity reaching some areas by the summer or the fall. So that means some people will have been living without electricity or water for at least a year.
Let's go to our callers now. Francisco is on the line in Milwaukee. Francisco, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Francisco?
Well, you guys were talking about there's a lot of issues in the island around the logistic and everything. Well, even though we're a small island, we cover most of the island with mountains, so a lot of those electric cords and power went off because of they went out from the mountains. I have all my family living there. My sister still without power. You guys, I don't know if you guys remember about Irma, the storm that came before the hurricane.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, they were without power. So it's almost like the Maria was in December. So basically from start of September, they were without power. A lot of people are still without power. And basically, it's something that the island wasn't prepared for it. The government wasn't prepared for it. Because we've been a lot of time without that big hurricane coming through. But still, people thinking that. But most of groceries and the food that people from U.S. send to the island are still in the ports because they're still moving it now. There are a lot of people without power, as I said before, and so if I have a truck, I can drive because I don't know where to go.
Francisco, thanks a lot. Good luck to your family. Hope they get power back soon. Francisco, Charles saying that even some of the relief that's there is sitting there. Is that right?
Yes. Part of it is that there hasn't been enough resources in the ports to unload some issues. There are still some towns that don't have bridges that haven't been rebuilt. So there are some towns that are, or communities rather, that are still disconnected. There hasn't been enough of a cleanup of the debris, so it's still hard to drive in some areas. There aren't traffic lights in some areas functioning. In some areas, even in San Juan. There are a lot of folks who are living in the mountains and communities that don't have access to basic needs, basic resources.
And Francisco also saying there was no real hurricane preparedness and recovery plan before the event.
There was a plan. The governor refused to enact it. And that was discussed in public hearings. They had, and that resulted in lack of the lack of communication throughout the island. But the island did have an emergency preparedness plan. It's just the governor did not enact it or implement it.
Francisco, thanks a lot for calling in. Appreciate it. We've heard calls on Wednesday. Senator Marco Rubio said lawmakers should pass a disaster relief package for Puerto Rico. Do you think Congress is going to do something like that anytime soon, Charles?
Well, the latest conversation on the relief package is that the Fiscal Oversight Board is going to negotiate a fiscal plan for the government, and they're talking about approving a $10 billion a year, five-year rebuilding plan. That's going to be partly managed by the Fiscal Oversight Board, or at least money expenditures higher than $10 million. I think it's going to happen sooner or later. The question is how efficient it's going to be and what structure is going to be in place to manage federal funds.
And I wanted to ask about another issue you brought up earlier, Charles. People leaving Puerto Rico, as you said, often working-age people. You've got some in your state of Connecticut. We hear a lot of people in Florida. How big are we talking about this outflow of people from Puerto Rico to the mainland United States?
That's a very good question. In the Puerto Rican government, the Department of Statistics already complained that the Puerto Rican government is not measuring the outflow accurately. They're estimating that about 2% of the population is leaving or
probably between 200,000 to 300,000 people. TSA reported 850 petitions for something called temporary shelter assistance to help them with hotels and relocation. We don't know, but there is an estimate that around probably between 300,000 and 400,000 people, maybe 500,000 people, may leave the island in the next year or so, or next 2 years. That's the latest estimate that we're getting, but we really won't know for a couple more months.
Go back to our callers now. Ryan is on the line in Madison. Ryan, hi.
Hi there. It's kind of disappointing that our government can't, you know, we have giant ships that can pull in off the coast and act as hospitals and bases, produce water from the ocean. We have logistics capabilities and the ability to build bridges. We've seen that in Iraq and Afghanistan, dozens of other nations. It's amazing that hasn't happened.
Ryan, thanks for the call. Charles, the role of the U.S. military potentially in rebuilding?
So Puerto Rico could be an example of all the great things that the United States could do. The military did begin, or at least initially began, a process of rebuilding or fixing. But they ran into a lot of tension with local mayors who wanted to control the distribution of goods and materials. And it's an expensive project. And they didn't have the necessary resources to clear the island and rebuild the basic infrastructure that they needed. So, yes, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers could do a better job, but they haven't. And it's a little bit too expensive for President Trump to finance.
Ryan, thanks a lot for that call. Charles, on a personal note, the first time we talked to you about this, I think you had family there. Your mother was still on the island. She has since left, I think. What's going on with your family now as it relates to Puerto Rico?
That's an ongoing conversation. My mother arrived. We managed to bring her up 2 weeks after the hurricane, and we literally saved her life because she had a pneumonia and a heart condition that she picked up as a result of the trauma that she suffered. And she is leaving for Puerto Rico tomorrow.
Oh, wow.
She's light arrived about 3 weeks ago to her apartment. She lives two blocks away from the wealthiest zone in the island, and they had no light until first week of January. And then last week, they lost power, so she has no water and electricity. So she's returning to her home because she's 74, and she wants to be in her home. And she's not sure whether she's going to have power or water from now on. We'll see how long she lasts under those conditions.
And so she might come back here if those conditions don't change.
I'm hoping, but she's a little stubborn, and her sisters and cousins are in Puerto Rico, and she wants to enjoy them. And it's too cold up in Connecticut and Massachusetts. But she's leaving tomorrow morning to return to her apartment. We'll see. I'll know in a week.
And good luck to her. And do we know I know the statistics are tough here. Do we know if a lot of people who left are starting to go back to Puerto Rico?
We know some people are starting to go back, but they don't have anywhere to go back to or jobs. The problem is that FEMA is bringing a lot of folks to the States, and they're giving them temporary assistance. But, for example, in the state of Connecticut, FEMA's already cutting temporary assistance, and people are left in the streets without any money either to return or to survive, at least in the state of Connecticut. But I'm hearing similar stories in Florida. So it's a tough situation. Plus, half the schools aren't, or at least a third of the schools aren't up or don't have electricity and don't have any food. So students who are enrolled in the States are likely to finish the semester and then see what happens. But it's an ongoing disaster, and that's the problem. It's hard for people to return to the island unless they have some sort of resources or family.
Well, good luck to your family, Charles, and thanks for joining us today.
Anytime. Thank you.
That's Charles Venator Santiago, associate professor at the University of Connecticut. He joined us for an update on the latest news out of Puerto Rico. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, we'll find out how Wisconsin and some other states have cut rates of crime and rates of incarceration in recent years. We'll preview the race for Wisconsin Supreme Court on Monday, and then throughout the week, we're going to meet the three different candidates running in this nonpartisan primary for what's often seen as a partisan Supreme Court. And we'll talk to the author of a new book on the history of Mexican Americans and how they became seen as a race, a separate ethnic and racial identity in the states. That's coming up Monday here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Monday after 8, discussing race can feel risky. People worry about escalating tension, triggering offense, or revealing personal ignorance. Kate's guest says people from all backgrounds have a responsibility to try and talk about race. She offers some suggestions on crafting meaningful dialogue about the future without becoming stuck in the past. That's Monday after 8 on The Morning Show. Coming up next is news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then House Republicans release the controversial Nunes memo with the approval of the president. That's amidst concern from Democrats and members of the intelligence community. We'll dig into the contents of the memo and reactions from both sides of the aisle. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
If you've never given before, but you look forward to listening to WPR every day, that's a sign it's time to donate. It means that WPR is important to you, and you are important to us. We're listener-supported radio, which means we count on money from people like you to make the programs possible. Make your first-ever contribution today at WPR.org. Thank you.
Wisconsin Public Television would like to thank its viewers for making the first year of Wisconsin PBS Kids 24/7 channel a success.
I'm just going to throw you a party! Hooray!
Whenever and wherever the children in your life are seeking top quality, educational, fun television, Wisconsin Public Television is there for you. Watch over the air or stream anytime, anywhere at WPT.org.
Way to get down with the bits!